I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and this is Radio Times in Review, our weekly show when we go back into our archives and highlight some of the best conversations from Radio Times past. On today's edition of the show, Soldiers of War. We'll hear from Mary Roach, known for finding unusual stories about unusual topics. For her book Grunt, she focused on the weirdest uses of science by the military. We'll also hear from Eric Fair, who worked as an interrogator at the infamous Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. His memoir, Consequence, deals with some of the more horrific forms of prisoner interrogation and the remorse he's felt for employing them. But first, we'll listen to a portion of my conversation with Marine infantry officer and journalist David Morris, in which we discuss the effects of post-traumatic stress disorder, the subject of a recent book. That's all coming up when Radio Times in Review continues after the news from NPR. This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thanks for joining us today. We're going to begin our show about soldiers of war by listening first to my interview with Marine infantry officer and journalist David Morris. He suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder as a result of his time in Iraq. Since his return and his experience with PTSD, he decided to explore the topic by interviewing researchers, veterans, and others who've been inflicted with the disorder, including survivors of rape and domestic abuse. He wrote about his experience in his 2015 book, The Evil Hours. Let's take a listen. You wrote, "I first got interested in PTSD when I read a newspaper article about how some Iraq War veterans felt poisoned," that was their word, "poisoned by the war." What was it about that word or what they were saying that struck you?
I guess what I noticed when I first returned from Iraq the first time in 2004, I just felt slightly out of time and out of place. I had only been to the Middle East for about 3 months, but it felt like 10 years had passed. And in that way, apart from even the poisoning feeling, there is this sense you get when you talk to veterans and other trauma survivors that for instance, going to a war is almost like a form of time travel. And you do come back and things are different. The clothes seem different. The people seem different. The language seems to have changed. And there's stories that you've missed out on that you're not aware of. So you have this sort of Rip Van Winkle feeling. And that was kind of how, over time, I noticed that the war had put me out of time, in a sense, from everyone else. And that feeling of apartness and separation is something that I think a lot of veterans and a lot of trauma survivors feel, that they've lived in this underworld, this alternate form of consciousness for a period of time. And as they're coming out and trying to reintegrate themselves into the world, that is when you begin to notice that you are different and the world is different. And there's this process of reintegration that needs to occur.
Not to boil PTSD down to one thing, but there is a kind of basic question that you say is integral to understanding PTSD, which is, how do you live after you've almost died? I mean, in certain ways, you have lived that because you were in this near-death experience in a way. But that's a question we need to grapple with in order to understand PTSD.
Yeah, and that's sort of one of the many vexing philosophical questions at the heart of PTSD is, how does human consciousness change? How does memory change? How do people's sense of themselves change after they've been very, very close to the end of consciousness, the end of the possible end of life? And researchers in the 1970s who first began putting the ideas together for PTSD began speaking to rape survivors and discovered, and prior to the 1970s, rape had sort of been thought of as a really unfortunate set of circumstances, but not really a capital crime. And researchers in Boston who interviewed rape survivors found that almost all of them felt and were convinced that they would die, that they would either be killed or it was the death of part of themselves, the incidents of being raped. So that sort of the idea that PTSD could come, mm-hmm. that there needed to be some sort of recognition of that particular experience was a big part of the story of PTSD and why it's such a big part of our culture. Is we recognize, you know, you could say that, you know, 5 to 6% of all American women have suffered from PTSD because of the problem we have with rape in our country.
Let me take you back, if I can, to this is October 2007, and you're embedded in Iraq. You're in Baghdad in a Humvee going through the streets with some soldiers there, and the Humvee hits an IED. Describe, if you can, that moment. I mean, there is a real before and after.
Yeah, I was on a patrol with the 1st Infantry Division, and we were asked by the headquarters to go check out this street, which was on fire. And there were the Shia burning out their Sunni neighbors, and sort of this slow-motion ethnic cleansing happening there. So we drove down this street, and as the patrol entered, we discovered that we'd actually driven into a dead end. So the patrol decided they had to turn around, do a three-point turn, and get out of there. And so one of the last things I remember clearly is the armored personnel carrier, the Bradley, at the front of the column, beginning to pivot and turn around, and the tracks grinding on the asphalt. So as we began to back up, we hit something. Mm-hmm. We hit an IED buried in the trash. Time got a little bit fuzzy. It was a little bit weird. And the Humvee caught on fire. And everyone in the Humvee, no one was physically injured, although everyone inside the vehicle lost their hearing. But eventually, we made it back to the patrol base. And then a half hour later, I was in a clinic getting my head examined. And then a week later, I was back in California, back in the United States.
I mean, was that a real one of those sort of before and after experiences? So at that moment, you, not to be overly dramatic here, but in a sense, you became a different person?
Well, yes and no. That was certainly the most melodramatic confrontation I had with the war, in a sense. But, you know, I lived in Iraq off and on for, you know, from 2004 to 2007, about 10 months in country total. And, you know, there was one unit I was with that was mortared every day for 7 days. So there was every day you would see. And, you know, I went to Fallujah and Ramadi and some of the worst places in the war. And that's an important thing to recognize, is that for veterans and the way the wars are fought now, like an Afghanistan veteran, in many cases, there's not always one single cardinal life-changing event. There often is, but just as powerful are the daily stresses and the daily exposure to privation, the hot and cold and the lack of privacy, and then just living in the shadow of death for, you know, your entire 7 month or 15 month deployment. So it often is one single event and then a culmination of what some clinicians call small T traumas.
You come back to the States, and it seems like there's almost like a honeymoon that you have, because it really isn't until 2 years later, till 2009, that you begin to experience some of these overt symptoms of PTSD. Why do you think that lag time?
Most of the research in my life sort of bears this out, is there is sort of this honeymoon period when you return from the war. And I think it's generally about 30 days, maybe one lunar cycle. You come back and you're not, you know, your family is sort of a little bit hesitant, and your social circle can be a little bit hesitant at first. But then as everyone settles back into the normal rhythm of life, and you notice that your place in that normal rhythm is not what it used to be, then you begin to – that readjustment process has to begin or fails to begin in some cases. But for me, I noticed that I felt different. You know, to bring it back to some of the larger political issues, I came back in 2004, watched the first Battle of Fallujah, and Abu Ghraib happened when I was in Iraq. And then I returned in July 2004, and then President Bush was reelected in November, which was very upsetting and disillusioning for me because of what I had seen. So I began to I had voted for President Bush the first time, and so that was a very upsetting and alienating and disorienting process to observe, considering my experiences in Iraq. But subsequent to that, with respect to more specifically psychiatric or medical experiences that I had, it wasn't until 2009, and I don't really have a good answer for why there was that gap, but what happened in 2009 was I was in a movie theater watching an action movie. It was not a war movie. It was a Marvel Comics superhero movie. And in the movie, there was an explosion, an IED depicted in the movie, and it was shot in the Humvee from the same point of view that I would have held, which is, you know, the back of the Humvee, maybe the back right. And so the scene in the movie, and it was so realistically rendered, and it was so loud in the theater that it really became, for me, it was just overwhelming because it was so close to what I imagined my death might look like. And so in the movie theater, this vision overwhelmed me and overwhelmed my mind, which kind of shut down like an overloaded electrical grid. And I basically kind of blacked out. And, you know, when I regained full consciousness, it was in the hallway of the Cineplex I was in. And you know, and I had my body.
So you lost
was,
time in a sense between that moment and there you were in the hallway.
Yeah,
talking about time.
Yeah, and I had to run. You know, I ran out of the theater. Eventually I calmed myself down a little bit and then slipped back into the theater and sat down next to my girlfriend at the time that I was seeing the movie with. And I'm like, well, what happened? She's like, well, there was an explosion in the movie and you ran out. And so that was kind of the first hint that I had that I was on the other side of something.
I wonder too, and you write about this and I'm sure a lot of other people who have been to war come back to the United States, especially these two wars, Iraq and Afghanistan, just feeling angry because so much of the country is so uninvolved and so unengaged with war. It's happening over there. It doesn't really intrude on our lives.
Yeah, and that's a really tricky thing. And I was actually talking to a veteran yesterday, a New Jersey National Guardsman, and we were talking about things. And anger management is kind of one of the major issues for returning veterans, in part because as a soldier, you're trained to be violent and you're trained to be, you know, to use violence to control, you know, to defeat the enemy. And so it's just – it becomes sort of a being a soldier is a different form of an experience. And so you have to learn how to control your anger and your frustration in a different way. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that it's just – as a soldier and deployed overseas, you do suffer a lot. There's a lot of exposure to the elements and a lack of privacy. And I know, speaking for myself, it's just when you get back to the U.S., it's hard to, you know, life is frustrating, but you have to find a new way to express, you know, your frustrations or your anxiety. And so, like, anger management is kind of one of the sort of subsets that's not in the official diagnosis for PTSD, but it's certainly a common experience among PTSD survivors.
Did you want to talk about what you had seen when you came back to the States? Did you feel like people would understand what you had seen and experienced?
I did want to talk about it, and I felt like I had seen, you know, in 2004, you know, many of us remember 11 years ago now, there was this, you know, Iraq was the political discussion of the year, I mean, in terms of the media and the coverage. But so you come back and you've seen a lot of things, at least you think you have. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people are not really, you know, Americans don't really, you know, part of coming back from the war was this real disappointment in my country. I was very, you know, I served in the Marine Corps. I was very much a patriotic young American, but I was really disappointed in what I learned about America when I returned. Because America is not a very introspective country, we're not very retrospective, and there didn't seem to be a deep enough interest in what was really at stake in the Middle East and in Iraq, and there wasn't really a willingness to sort of learn about Arab culture or how we were going to win the war. There was this just very polarized political sense of you tended to get two or three types of comments. Like the number one thing was like people would ask you, "Well, did you kill anybody over there?"
I know.
And then other people would make a lot of people made racist comments about Arabs, saying, you know, and stuff that has appeared in the American Sniper book, which, you know, Chris Kyle was obviously an Iraq veteran, but I stridently reject that way of looking at Arabs as savages. But a lot of Americans do believe that, and which I think is insulting and a really ignorant way to, you know, to interpret. You know, the people from, you know, Arabs. So I was, you know, that is a very common response, though, is people have these very sort of closed-minded views about, you know, what the war is really all about. And that was not, you know, that I got to know Iraqis. I knew a lot of Marines that taught themselves Arabic overseas in order to be better warriors, in order to serve their country. And so you come back and you deal with this really noxious political environment where people don't seem to want to learn. And it's very frustrating.
Are you still angry?
Oh, totally. Yeah, it's something I've tried to let go of and not really dwell on, because anger, you know, trauma is caused by thousands of different kinds of things. You know, there are a million ways to be traumatized, but if you indulge and sit and stew in your anger, there's one place that you're going to end up, and that's you alone in a room, probably with a bottle. And so you have to, you know, that was one reason, that was sort of one growth process of writing this book, was accepting that you have to let some of that anger go.
That was my 2015 conversation with Marine Infantry Officer and journalist David Morris about his book, The Evil Hours, a biography of post-traumatic stress disorder. When we get back from the break, we'll hear from a former interrogator from the infamous Abu Ghraib prison. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Soldiers of War edition of Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Perhaps the most disturbing images of the war in Iraq came from Abu Ghraib prison, which featured American soldiers joking and laughing at naked, humiliated, and even deceased prisoners. The pictures led to a greater awareness about abusive interrogation tactics and even torture employed by American forces. Eric Fair was one of those interrogators employed by a private security firm at the time. His memoir, Consequence, deals with the prison complex and the use of quote-unquote enhanced interrogation, as well as his remorse for having been involved in their use. He joined us earlier this year to discuss. Do you feel by writing and, in a sense, confessing, because much of what you've been writing about is confessing what you did, that you will be forgiven, that you are forgiven? Are you looking to forgive yourself?
Yeah, certainly the word forgiveness gets used throughout the book, and it even appears in the opening statement there. But the book is not about forgiveness. It certainly is a confession, and it's certainly I'm making an effort to be as honest and as open as I can, which I think is really the only way to approach this kind of transgression, which I think is true for the nation as well. So there's certainly my story, which I've tried to be as honest about as I can. But I think the nation, with things like the release of the Senate torture report and continued open debate about the people that were involved in this program, is it's something that's required of us.
Do you worry, though, that many people have moved on? They're not thinking about Abu Ghraib. They're not thinking about interrogation. They've forgotten about the Senate report. You know, we don't have troops the way we did in Iraq. We're looking at other parts of that world.
Yeah, and it was interesting. We're reinserting troops back into Iraq.
We
now,
are.
Right? Advisors. And throughout our nation's history, we often introduce advisors into different parts of the world, and that tends not to end very well. So the idea that the war in Iraq is over, I think, is simply untrue. Certainly the war in Afghanistan rages on. And I think looking at just about any regional threat, there's a good indication that we are going to go back to war. I mean, that's our history. That's really every nation's history. It may be 10, 15, 20 years. But the issue of interrogation and how we deal with prisoners of war will be something that we continue to talk about. We have Donald Trump saying waterboarding and so much worse. And we certainly focus on Donald Trump and the show that he is. But there are a large, significant portion of Americans who support what he says. It's hard to know if it's a majority. I guess we'll find out in November. But it certainly seems that there is still a very strong voice for torture.
I thought it was interesting when he said that, that some of the military higher-ups basically said, we would disobey that order.
Right, yeah.
I mean, does that give you some confidence that we might have learned something from what we did?
That addresses a couple of different issues. One is the Army is not necessarily allowed to disobey legal orders. And Donald Trump isn't suggesting that he would institute waterboarding and so much worse and then keep it quiet. He has come out and said he would make it legal. And he would get support of the Congress, so they'd pass a law and make this stuff legal again. And if it's legal, the Army, if ordered, has an obligation to do that. So it's encouraging that there are people in uniform that say that this is beneath the armed services and beneath the United States. And those voices have always been out there. But and this gets a little bit into the theme of the book. I'm not exposing something that we were trying to keep secret or that was hidden. I'm simply writing about what was policy and what we were doing. Not behind closed doors, but in front of officers and supervisors. And there was no fear that we were going to be exposed. So certainly we were calling it enhanced interrogation at the time. I think most have moved on to recognize that it's torture. But going back down this path is very easy.
You say a number of interesting things in this book. One is that torture does work, but it's a question of the morality of torture, which is, of course, a whole other question.
Yeah. Well, and again, I mean, each question that we get into here opens just a can of worms and about whether or not torture works. I think, again, human history makes it pretty clear that inflicting some kind of physical or mental pain on someone can make certain people do certain things, to include divulge information that they'd rather not. But the question of whether or not torture works should really be about a question of, is it the most effective technique in terms of speaking with prisoners of war? And clearly it is not. I don't think there's any evidence to suggest that it is. And again, as I've answered in many other times, none of that matters, or at least none of that should matter, that it really is a question of morality. And maybe we do need a leader to step forward and say, Look, it maybe torture is effective, and maybe it would accomplish some of the goals, but we can't use it. And we as Americans have an obligation to accept some of the risks that come with holding these kind of these high ideals.
You don't think a leader has said that, as Obama said that, to your satisfaction?
Not to my satisfaction, no. And I mean, I have great respect for President Obama, and he certainly ended the program the day he took office and has struggled, I think, to close Guantanamo Bay, which I don't think is entirely on him. But I think I don't think we've had a public leader at this point who has said that there are certain risks that we assume as Americans, and that if our real goals are issues like freedom, that comes with there are certain risks associated with that. Everyone who wears the uniform recognizes that that's the case. You don't put on a uniform, whether it's as a police officer or a soldier or a Marine, and not realize that you're putting your life on the line. And I'm not suggesting that every civilian should have to face death every day, but certainly as a civilian of the United States, there are certain risks that you assume as a citizen.
You write this book in present tense, and I know that seems like a kind of shallow response, but I thought that was obviously an interesting choice on your part. It wasn't using the past tense about the things that have happened to you, but puts us as readers in the middle of your life. Was that the idea?
Yeah. I mean, there were, like any writer, I went through a number of different revisions throughout the book, and some of the original ones started in the past tense and said about the things that I had done. And maybe even tried to explain and suggest that torture was like, or Iraq was like this, or it was as if this had happened. And I recognized just kind of the impotence of that kind of language, and that the only way to do it was to just sort of put myself and also the reader right back into that situation. And it speaks to another issue, the idea that I try not to suggest that that I tortured someone in the past or that I was a torturer. That, you know, I own that. I am. I did these things, and it's not something I can simply close the book on and move forward. These are now, this is a part of who I am. And also, speaking about the nation, it's a part of who we are now.
You're a Marine. You spent time in the Marine Corps.
I was a soldier, actually.
I'm sorry. Yes, you're absolutely right. Well, you would know, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
And then, I mean, you had some health problems.
Mm-hmm.
And was working in a police force in Lehigh Valley.
I was, yeah.
And the health problems essentially disqualified you for that job.
Yeah.
But it didn't disqualify you to be a contractor for this group, CACI CACI.
Yeah, well, whether or not it should have disqualified me is I'm not sure. But they at that time, contracting companies were not there was no physical exam that I had to go through. Post 9/11, I considered reenlisting, and I was a police officer, and so I was with that job. And then, as you said, when I lost that job because of the heart condition, the desire to stay involved in what was going on was overwhelming.
Which is why you wanted to be a contractor?
Well, contracting at that point was the only option for me to get back to Iraq as quickly as I could. I mean, again, this was late 2003. The belief, I think, at that point was that the war in Iraq was going to end very quickly, maybe a few weeks, maybe a few months, but certainly no longer than a year or two. And so the idea of even reenlisting at that point, it would have taken me a couple of months to get back into a unit to train, and there's no way to know if I would have deployed. Contracting offered me an immediate entrance into Iraq, and so I was signed up in late December and was there by January.
In fact, no interview. I mean, basically just sign on the dotted line. And
there were a couple of phone calls just to make sure that I had paperwork in order. But no, there was no what you would think of as a job interview. There was nothing like that.
You write, as former soldiers and Marines, none of us were comfortable with the lack of planning, lack of support, and lack of proper supplies. No weapons, no communications equipment, no maps, nothing for first aid. We all expect something to go wrong very soon. And no armor as well. So basically, dropped in the middle of a war without any protection.
Yeah, again, Saddam Hussein had been captured in December. And so I think even when we were there in January, the feeling was, and even the rhetoric from the administration at that point was that the war was over and that what you're dealing with was just kind of the last gasp of the insurgency. Those of us who were there obviously knew far different. It was an active war zone. IEDs were ramping up and certainly incoming rounds. But again, it was hard as a former soldier, and I assume as a former Marine, to walk away from that. And it's drilled into your head, and I think in a good way, that you make do with what you have, and you know simple things like you simply complete the mission, right? And you can continue to try to improve your equipment and whatever else that is that you have, but you have an obligation to do the job with whatever you're given.
You spoke some Arabic.
And
you were an interrogator. What was your What was the job description, and what were you told you were supposed to find out?
Well, the original job description was simply just interrogator. And I think certainly my impression was that we'd be interrogating prisoners of war back in the rear, maybe even in a place like Kuwait. And army or military interrogation is more like a debriefing. And so the idea is that you get soldiers into your interrogation booth, and you want to find out what unit they were in and what kind of equipment they had and how high their morale was and how likely were their comrades to attack or surrender, and then pass that information up to higher. But what Abu Ghraib was and what Iraq was really far more law enforcement, and the idea that we weren't quite sure we weren't even sure what the insurgency was at this point. Certainly someone like me who had been an Arabic linguist knew Iraq's history and knew about the Sunni and the Shia, but we didn't have a good, clear indication of whether or not the Sunni and the Shia were going to work together, whether or not they'd be able to form a government, whether or not once some of the attacks started, if it was the Sunni and Shia working together against us. And so there was just there were just unknowns. The whole place was an unknown. And so each interrogation was in many ways a law enforcement mm-hmm. interrogation.
You talk about, quote unquote, getting things done. I mean, essentially that was your mission, your job, to get things done.
Yeah, the job was to get information, yes.
Abu Ghraib, just the scale of Abu Ghraib is hard to describe.
Large place.
Can you? Yeah, how large a place? How sprawling?
Yeah, I'm not sure there's any comparison to be made, but it was a number of prisons within one large complex. And Iraq is, at least that portion of Iraq is incredibly flat. And so even those of us who were in the prison, it was hard to kind of get a grasp of just how large the prison was, certainly if you saw it from the helicopter. We actually lived in one of the prisons, one of our living facilities.
In the cells,
yeah,
right?
We actually lived in a cell, and, you know, you could close the doors, and the old cafeterias that were there where the prisoners would eat. And then you'd walk across the open fields to another prison complex. Now, most of the Iraqi prisoners were kept in open-air camps, and then just a limited few were in what is now known as the hard site, which was simply just another prison building where the higher value prisoners were kept.
You described the hard site.
Well, yeah.
What did it look like?
You know, it's interesting.
What did you see?
The question comes up a lot, and justifiably so. And I, walking into the hard site was in many ways like walking into any other prison. I'd been a police officer, so I'd been in many American prisons, county prisons. And so it was a two-tiered prison, open bay in the middle with cells along the walls. But the number of – and I was sort of slow to recognize as I walked in. I walked in and I saw a naked prisoner in his cell, and just seeing one, it wasn't so much of a shock as just kind of not fully understanding what was going on. And then walking a little further and seeing another one and then another one. And then each cell that you walked by, someone was either naked or locked or handcuffed to the cell wall. And then a line of what I assumed were newly arrived prisoners, you know, being stripped naked and dragged around the floor if they weren't getting their pants off quickly enough. And it was cold. It was January, and this Iraq certainly gets hot in the summer, but cold in the winter. By the time I'd spent a good 20 minutes to a half an hour, it was a recognition that it was at least in retrospect, probably one of the first recognitions that I was involved in something that I was going to pay a pretty high price for.
Were you shocked by what you saw?
Yeah, that's a hard question. I don't know. I wasn't shocked. If I'd been shocked, I would have liked to have said I would have done something. And I'm guilty of not having done anything. So I don't think I was shocked. And again, I think the desire to be a part of that mission and feeling so connected to the U.S. military and serving in that war, that I accepted on some level that it was going to be unpleasant. And so it was hard. It was very difficult to know what you were supposed to be shocked by, which I know in retrospect sounds hard to believe. But the recognition wasn't that I had done something wrong or illegal. The recognition was that I was a part of something brutal and ugly. It took me a number of years to make that conclusion. It was torture.
When you were there, when you were in Iraq, how much did you think about what was going on as much as you have since coming back from Iraq?
Well, we thought about it on a daily basis. I certainly think about it differently now. There were, all interrogators had discussions about what the limits were. And there were discussions, often discussions about a technique that we knew was illegal. You could not threaten a detainee with death. So you couldn't say, if you don't tell me this, I'm going to shoot you. That was clearly a violation. But there were discussions about what could we do, or was it illegal to plant the idea that if a detainee didn't cooperate, that they may die? And one way to do that was to suggest That if you don't cooperate, we're going to send you to Egypt or to the Egyptians, right? And the assumption was
rendition or something
right,
like that.
Right. Yeah. Well, we weren't. The Iraqis wouldn't have known that word, but just the idea that, or even worse, to Israel, right? I mean, or to even Guantanamo Bay. At this point, Guantanamo Bay had a much stronger sort of record for the Iraqis than even Abu Ghraib did. So we would have those discussions. Can we do that and then make the detainee think that they're going to be killed there? And I think the overwhelming answer was no. You know, we can't do that. So there were, as strange as it may seem, there were absolutely discussions and conclusions that there were certain things that we could not be doing.
I'm sure some people listening to us would say, oh, you know, I would never do that. I would never cross that line. And I remember saying this to you back in 2008, where I made the assumption that you're a good person. I think you were at Princeton Theological Seminary time. So I thought that was some indication that this was a person who was interested in morality and goodness and perhaps badness. But what you're saying is that even a quote-unquote good person can do some of these things that in this case – our torture.
Yeah, well, there were no bad people. And I mean, there were a few people who I didn't like to work with and some people who annoyed me, like any office environment. But I worked with really good people. And CACI, which has taken a lot of flack and maybe rightfully so, hired good people, many unqualified and in positions that maybe they shouldn't have been. But again, this is a large scale interrogation in the Middle East, which we'd not done before. Essentially, all of us were unqualified. So yeah, I know people. It's easier to think that this is done by evil people and people that were, you know, mean to animals when they were kids. But it's simply not true. It was done by well-meaning Americans who wanted to serve. And you can certainly have long arguments about whether or not the war should have been fought. But when we were there in 2004 and 2005, we thought that we were doing the right thing, and we were surrounded by other people who agreed with us.
You're very honest about how guilty you feel. I don't know how – I don't want to frame – this is going to come out more harsh than I mean it. Mm-hmm. Is it the guilt about what you did or what you didn't do? And by that, I mean didn't do by either stopping someone or sounding the alarm while you were still in Iraq.
I think over the years – so the initial guilt, I think, was some of the things that I had done. And so this becomes a strange kind of thing because there's a part of me that wants to say I did very little in terms – the vast majority of my interrogations were open and honest, and I used my language, and I was effective as an Arabic interrogator. And I just kind of – sort of almost sampled some of these techniques very briefly and was very uncomfortable with them and did not use them. But I have no right to do that. You know, I'm if we're guilty in terms of this being torture, I'm as guilty as anyone. And so I wanted to steer clear of suggesting that I somehow am less guilty than someone else. We're all essentially in this same boat. So, but as time went on, I think it became I struggled more with the idea that and certainly when I started writing in 2006 that I had not stopped these things, and I had not gone to someone and said, hey, look, this is beneath us and we shouldn't be doing it.
That was my conversation with Eric Fair, former interrogator and author of the memoir Consequence. When we get back from the break, we'll hear from author and journalist Mary Roach about the strange science of the military. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Warfare, aside from being an act of violence, is an act of scientific exploration and discovery. Think about all we have learned from battlefield medicine. Author and journalist Mary Roach, who has become one of the most beloved popular science writers working today, decided to find out some of the weirder examples of science that armies employ, things like chili peppers and maggots. She discussed all these quirks in her eighth and newest book called Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War. She joined me earlier this year. Let's take a listen. I have to say, even reading through it, it was a reminder for me about how much time we have spent at war. I mean, obviously, the kind of investment that we have made in war, building bombs and things like that. But then the other side of this, which is the investment we've made as a country to try to protect soldiers and Marines from actual warfare.
Right. And things that you don't necessarily think about. I mean, you think about combat casualty care, medevacs, and keeping people from bleeding to death and, you know, the emergency stuff that everybody sees in films, but then kind of the background misery of heat and back pain and sleep loss. And, you know, I'm on a book tour and I find myself, I complain about it. I get up at 5 a.m. and I'm like, just shut up. You know, are you walking around? Do you feel okay? Then stop complaining.
It's interesting you say that, because I was thinking about, you know, what it must be like to be sleeping in the middle of a war, which of course is impossible. We worry about, you know, truck drivers not getting enough sleep because of safety issues. And I'm thinking about these soldiers, Marines that are getting catnaps here and there, and the effect that it has on their ability to do their job and also just their emotional state.
Right, right. Yeah, no, I spent time on a ballistic missile submarine, and the science I was reporting on was a new watch bill. They were trying to, because for a long time, they, in order to keep somebody watching, if you're on a ballistic missile submarine, it's nuclear. It's got nuclear bombs on it, but it's also nuclear powered, so it can stay under. It doesn't have to go refuel or stock up, so it can stay hidden. So you have this situation where you need people up all the time watching it. So how do you get let people sleep, but also you know, have the posts filled all the time? And what they were doing for many years was changing the length of the day. So in essence, messing with circadian rhythm. So not only were people sleep deprived and overworked, plus they're studying for their qualification, so they're just flat out busy. But now it's like flying to Paris every day.
Wow, yeah. Wow.
Minus the Paris part.
I mean, dealing with this nuclear powered.
Right, right.
Vessel.
So you know, that's a situation. This is a roving nuclear arsenal. You don't really want people asleep on the job.
What got you interested in this, in a sense, the science of not just warfare, but also how to protect soldiers?
Yeah, kind of an odd path to the book. I was reporting in India on the world's hottest chili pepper, the Bhut Jalokia, and arguably, there are people who say it's not. Anyway, a very, very hot chili pepper. There's a chili pepper eating contest, et cetera. And while I was there, I was told that the Indian Defense Ministry, the science arm, had created a non-lethal weapon using this chili pepper. So I went over to the neighboring state and I said, hello, I'd like to talk to you about your essentially a tear gas that they had made, tear powder. And while I was there, just nosing around and talking to people in the malaria unit, there was a project. They were developing a leech repellent and going out into the river and rolling up their trousers and testing this leech repellent. I thought, well, that's all very Mary Roach and interesting.
It's very Mary Roach and interesting.
And it occurred to me that military science is a broader and more esoteric undertaking, and it incorporates a lot of fields of science all at once. It's not just medicine. I mean, you think about emergency care and medicine, and that's part of the book as well. But just a lot of enabling me to just sort of stick a toe into like bioengineering and leech.
And leeches.
The leeches didn't make the cut.
I mean, warfare is about using things like leeches and stink bombs and, you know, very sort of basic stuff. And it's also Stuxnet and using, you know, computer viruses in order to take down another country or another company.
Right, sure, yeah. I mean, because the human body is my bag, I stuck to more the science that dealt with the everyday grind of and dangers of being in combat. And I thought that it was also because we all deal in one way or another with heat and loud noise and stress and fear. And I thought, you know, people could relate on that level as well, even if they're not in the military or haven't had that experience.
Sure. Well, certainly the issue of heat in places like Iraq, where my understanding in the summer the temperatures can be something like 120 mm-hmm. degrees, mm-hmm. and you've got soldiers, Marines wearing vests and Kevlar and carrying things around. How do they deal with that?
Well, they need to hydrate. But and what happens? And I didn't really have an understanding of heat injury and how that works. And it sets up this intense competition in the body for the fluids, and it's when you sweat, it comes from your plasma, the clear portion of the blood. Your body's capillaries in the skin dilate, and you get more blood going there, offloading the heat into vapor,
right.
So cooling you down.
And cooling you down.
Cooling you down that way, the heat goes off into the air. But if you're working hard, your muscles want that blood as well. So there's this competition. At a certain point, you know, at a certain point, somebody's going to lose out. When you have heat strokes, sometimes like the gut will shut down, you know, or you may not make it to the brain. You may faint. You know, that's less dangerous than heat stroke. But anyway, it's this. And as you said, you're working hard. You have this pack. You have this hot gear. And so the military, the USIS, the medical school, uniform services, University of Health Sciences, was looking at and they were doing a project while I was there. They have something called a cook box, casually, where you can create this scenario. There are treadmills, and you can put on gear. And when I was there, it was 100 degrees. There were a couple of Army Rangers wow. who were handling it quite well. I was not. But the point of it was, is there some way to, either through genetics or blood mark, or some way to identify people who are constitutionally not able to acclimate and who are wow. really hit hard? And if you could, then you could keep those people out of that extreme heat situation, because they're the ones that are going to come down with heat stroke. But it's tough, because even the ones that do well, because they can take the heat, they tend to get given the harder assignment. So they end up overexerting and getting hit with that. So it's tough to make it all work out. But that was the hope, that you could identify people, because you do acclimate. I mean, it's amazing.
You felt that as well?
You do well. No, it takes a couple of days. Right. And when I was in there, I saw these guys, they started to sweat right away. And I thought, I'm not sweating here. I'm doing okay. But in fact, that's because their body's like, okay, it's hot. Let's cool you down. Whereas my body was like, ooh, is there something going on here? Is it hot in here? I'd like to have a popsicle.
That's what your body sounds like?
Yeah, exactly. Kind of, ooh. So, and I wasn't sweating. So I got flushed, and I had to stop with the pack on 7 minutes.
Wow.
That's not much of a march.
No, and heavy. How heavy was the pack?
And mine was only 30 pounds.
And 30 pounds.
Uh-huh, not...
95 pounds?
Yeah.
Some of these...
Yeah, when body armor itself can be 30-something pounds.
Wow.
Yeah, and that, you know, you're carrying that. You're not just wearing it, you're carrying it.
One of the people said that, I don't know if this was scientific or just people trying to figure out, so how do I hydrate under these circumstances, which was to prehydrate, which was to drink just tons of water before going out into this.
That was an interesting, it's called pre-drinking. And there was a guy, Dr. Adolf, who looked into that some decades back, where he said, you know, you could use the body as a secondary storage tank and just tank up. And there was an argument that you would just pee it out. So he puts people, I'm not sure who his volunteers were, but he put them on a dehydration hike and had them pre-drink, found that they only peed out, I think it was around 15%, 15 to 25%. So the rest of that water was available to sweat. So, however, you know, pre-drinking is not a recommended approach in the military. So I don't know if Dr. Adolf's work has been found to be lacking in some way, but that's what he found. And I'm a pre-drinker.
You did find, I think there was some military manual, 422 pages on sweat.
Yes, exactly.
What does that tell us about the military?
That book was amazing. Dr. Yas Kuno, a Japanese physiologist, and he had this amazing these photographs of these people. He put this starch on them that would turn black when you sweat, and then he took photographs of the patterns of sweat and individual differences and where people sweat, and the photograph, they kind of look like they've broken out in some virulent mildew.
Wow.
These little black specks all over them. And it really just fascinating. And he talked about, when we look at where mankind has gone in the world, the reason we've been able to settle the equatorial regions is because of our sweat gland, that we are able to cool ourselves down and other organisms can't. So we've been able to travel the globe. And he really was like, civilization owes itself to the sweat gland.
And these are the kinds of people that you meet when doing books like this, right?
Exactly. People are so
single-minded
down
and passionate.
Yeah, and he spent 30 years studying perspiration and the thermoregulatory system, not just sweat, but the whole system. And I love people like him. I mean, he's no longer with us.
Well, you already talked about pee, about urine, so it's time to talk about dysentery, diarrhea. But when you think about it, how important that is in order to manage it, understand it, for people at war.
Right. There were conflicts, not so much now, but historically. I mean, the Mexican-American War, 7 cases of dysentery or malaria disease killed or inflicted itself on 7. The ratio was 7-1, disease to combat.
Right, so, 7-1.
Yeah, 7-1. William Osler, the father of modern medicine, had that great quote, "Dysentery has been more fatal to soldiers than powder or shot."
Wow.
So, and now diarrhea is dysentery, and dysentery is an extreme form of diarrhea where pathogens infect the lining of the intestine, and you have bloody stools. Sorry, everyone.
Yeah. But, it's Mary Roach. Yeah, what can we say?
Sorry. But today you have the WHO released a statistic, and it was last year, 2.2 million deaths per year. A lot of in developing nations, a lot of children dehydrating and dying from diarrhea. So and now, though, I mean, in Grunt, I ended up spending time with some special operations personnel in Djibouti, which is there's a lot of counterinsurgency work that goes on there. It's right near Somalia and Yemen. And special operations teams, they go out in very small groups and they are doing kind of classified, high risk, intense missions. And because they are spending time in a village eating not necessarily clean water and food that may not have been refrigerated, and the rates of diarrhea are twice as high in that population. You know, I talked to these special operations guys, and I had to do this. It was an awkward reporting situation because these guys are in a restricted zone, they off to themselves. They come out to eat because they don't have their own dining facilities.
And I would think whether contaminated food or you mentioned water, stress. I mean, there's so many reasons that this could be
right.
a problem.
Right. So I was there with a diarrhea researcher who said in a moment of passion about his topic, "I live and breathe this stuff." And he was talking about there are post-infectious consequences. You can have a bout of severe food poisoning and then find yourself with irritable bowel syndrome. And so there's a form of arthritis called reactive arthritis. Anyway, he was looking at a treatment regimen that would, you know, single dose, where you could knock it out quite quickly.
Maggots. I certainly have seen maggots. You take a walk in the woods, sometimes you'll see a dead carcass of an animal somewhere, and there are the maggots sort of roiling all over this carcass. And it is scary and kind of nauseating. But maggots, this is an important part of understanding people getting injuries in war and what, I guess, nature
mm-hmm.
can do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maggots, there's a maggot therapy, which is specifically, it's debridement. The maggots in a wound are eating dead. They specifically like to dine on dead tissue. And that serves a really important function in promoting healing of a wound. And this was discovered primarily by World War I, by a French expeditionary, Dr. William Baer. And these two patients came in who'd been lying in the woods for 7 days, and they came in and they had these large wounds that were infested, and of course everyone's horrified. They cleaned them out, and Baer noticed this amazing healthy pink tissue that was growing in.
Wow.
And noticed it happening enough that he thought something's going on here. The maggots, you'd think that they would cause infection. They seem to be preventing not only debridement but preventing infection. And he was the first to try this among civilians, and it worked. And they weren't getting infections, and the wow. wounds were healing, including really stubborn wounds. And nowadays, maggot therapy is used primarily on diabetics with foot ulcers that are not healing, because the maggots will go in there. They're very effective, and they're actually an FDA-approved medical device.
I read that. That's
fascinating. In the book, I have the Medicare reimbursement code for maggots. You have to be careful because there's a lot of care that has to go into it, and you don't want to leave them in too long, because if they leave the wound and want to go pupate and become flies, now you have flies in your hospital setting, and that's not good. So they have to be changed, and you have to find personnel who will deal with that. So the average hospital is a little like, not only because of the gross out factor, but because you definitely don't want flies right. in a hospital spreading germs. So.
Well, you said during the break that if you take one little maggot and put it on your finger, it's kind of cute.
Yeah, the maggots in that size, and they're about a day old and about a couple centimeters, they look like a cupcake sprinkle. That's the size they are, and they kind of inch along, and they're white, and It's only when they're in the, you know, this mass kind of pulsating feeding machine, because that's what they do. They just eat. And they're eating. It's good, the stuff that they're eating. You want them to be eating that. But if that was your wound, I mean, it is hard to imagine having that happen. But it's also, you have to keep in mind, if you have this wound that doesn't heal and the alternative is possibly even amputation,
right,
maggots are your friend and you welcome the maggots.
That was my conversation with popular science writer Mary Roach about her book, Grunt. She joined us earlier this year. And that wraps up this week's edition of Radio Times in Review. Radio Times is produced by Debbie Bilder, Liz Fiedler, Trine Nouri, and John Ahrens, who edits this show. I'm Marty Moscowing. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend.